This week on Your Western Context, Alberta wraps a successful spring session. CBC is turning off Facebook comments, and Trudeau paid more for less in buying vaccines. Also, our public health agency is held in contempt of Parliament as the Trudeau government covers up more and more. This is Western Context, episode 224, recorded Friday, June 18th, 2021. Contempt for the truth. Hello, everybody, and welcome to another episode of Western Context. Patrick and myself are back this week, and this week has certainly been an interesting week when it comes to the news. There's lots of things that we've wanted to talk about in past episodes, but we haven't had the chance to do so yet, and we're going to do that this week.
That's right. There's definitely a lot of news this week that has gone undercovered by the media, and that's why we're here to shed a light on it and kind of give you the context of what actually is going on in Canada this week and why exactly it matters that we should be talking about this a bit more.
And if you're joining us for the first time, Western Context is a podcast where we aim to cut through all the media bias and sensationalism that you find, whether it be in print, online, or even on TV, if you still watch television news broadcasts. And in doing so, hopefully, we'll provide all the information and context necessary to which you, our listeners, on the right side of the news. And we're going to begin with our Alberta story this week. And this is a big week for Alberta, because not only has the spring sitting of the legislature wrapped, but today, as of recording on Friday, June 18th, Premier Jason Kenney and Health Minister Tyler Shandro announced that as of July 1st, the province will enter Stage 3 of reopening and all restrictions will be rolled back. We still have questions for the cities of Edmonton and Calgary of whether or not they will keep their mask bylaws going forward, but these two interim weeks are the time to put pressure on our city officials to roll back these mask bylaws. Now, most of the coverage over the course of the spring session has, of course, been teemed with controversy, often fueled by the desire to cover those going against the restrictions that were put in place for most of the spring. And now, with this has led to a great many stories of not being covered by the mainstream media, and as such, we're going to run through some of the pieces of legislation that were enacted in the spring session. First and foremost, the Recall Act, otherwise known as Bill 52, was introduced into the legislature, giving Albertans the opportunity to fire their MLAs if enough constituents agree. The Recall Act is based largely on the legislation that exists in BC and was not supported by the opposition NDP, despite the bill being one of the most democratic pieces of legislation ever passed in Alberta. If the petition were approved, the applicant would have 60 days to gather the signatures of 40% of eligible voters in the constituency. And if successful, a recall vote would be held. And if that vote were successful, a by-election would then be held. Municipal officials such as councillors, mayors, and school trustees can also be recalled. The process is similar, however. There would be no recall vote if the threshold is met, and the official would simply be removed. The province also introduced and passed Bill 51, the Citizen Initiative Act. This bill allows individual Albertans to submit petitions on proposed legislative and policy changes directly to the legislature and propose constitutional referendum questions to the provincial government. The petitioner would have 90 days to gather the needed signatures. Successful petitions for legislative and policy initiatives would require signatures from 10% of voters province-wide, and successful petitions for constitutional initiatives would require the signatures of 20% of voters province-wide and 20% of voters in each of two-thirds of Alberta's electoral districts, which is 58 districts as of recording. When signatures are verified, legislative and policy initiatives would go to a committee of the legislature for them to investigate and report on. If the committee were to reject a proposal, it would automatically go to a plebiscite of the people. This means that it would be wise for politicians to act on what the people say rather than defying their will. Earlier in the session, the UCP brought back the Alberta Senate Election Act, allowing Albertans to elect senators and send them to Ottawa, and this was a process that was suspended under the former NDP government. The UCP also The UCP also entered Motion 85, formally requesting the Prime Minister to respect the democratic voices of Albertans and refrain from filling Alberta's two vacant Senate seats until after the October municipal elections, when the Senate elections will take place. Now, whether or not the Prime Minister does this is up for question. It would be a smart move to tamp down on feelings of Western alienation and give Alberta more of a voice in Ottawa, since we have no elected cabinet ministers from the province. It should also be noted that Notley and the NDP opposition voted against this motion as well. But the biggest and most consequential act of the session was the tabling of Motion 83 last week, which set the stage for a referendum on equalization later this fall. The question reads as follows. Should Section 36(2) of the Constitution Act, 1982, Parliament and the Government of Canada's commitment to the principle of making equalization payments be removed from the Constitution? Now, this was a story we wanted to give a deep dive last week, but we were unable to because of the necessity of covering the racist NDP convention and the lies being set up to run the 2023 campaign. Experts, so-called experts, have said that this referendum will have little bearing on whether or not equalization stays in the Constitution, and they're right on that. But the point that was missed by the experts and the media is that this referendum is to not outright remove equalization, but to force the federal government to the negotiating table to negotiate on a constitutional matter in good faith, as has been established by Jean Chrétien's Clarity Act of 2002. The goal at the end of the day would be to ultimately remove equalization, but that's unlikely to happen. We need to be 100% clear on that. The likely outcome, though, will be some form of reforms that make the program less hostile to Alberta and other half provinces. Most of the discussion that appeared this week when this motion was tabled failed to see what exactly the Clarity Act says and follow that through to the end goal. Instead, they just passed this up as a political statement against the Trudeau government, which it is not, and everybody should take it seriously. We'll have more coverage on equalization as we get closer to the October elections. The session caps off another busy session by the UCP, and despite the pandemic, the Alberta government has sat for more time than any other government in Canada. Government House Leader Jason Nixon said, quote, "I think all Albertans are eager to turn the page on what has been a tough year. And by far, the UCP's biggest accomplishment was checking off 83% of its campaign commitments. The UCP has been fulfilling election promises, and unlike some governments when elected, have actually kept most of their promises, which is surprising to many. This should be a story in itself, but it isn't, and this is why we always say elections have consequences."
Yeah, it's amazing to see just how many of the campaign commitments that the UCP has actually been able to do in its first term, and in the sense that Jason Kenney has been able to do pretty much most of what he said he was going to do in the middle of the pandemic, which I think he probably no one could have predicted, of course, but I think that for a first-term government, it's been a little bit more difficult on him than some of the other governments across the country. And certainly with the recall legislation that was put in, this is a very no-brainer sort of legislation that should be put in because it is giving power to the people, and it is one of the most democratic things ever passed. Now, it doesn't see much practice, of course, but it's kind of there almost as a sort of spare tire whenever you need it, whenever one of the tires that you do have, or MLAs in this case, decides to break down and you need to replace them sooner than the next election would be. And that's something that has been in BC for quite a number of decades. And it's amazing that Alberta, through all of its support of grassroots democratic movement, hasn't been able to put that in until the Jason Kenney government, of course. But there has been, of course, a lot of other things to go on with the spring session that have been talked about, and a lot that really hasn't received as much credit as it probably should have. And this is due to, of course, the media not really focusing on the accomplishments of the Kenney government and just trying to focus on other non-stories that get covered in the media that many different media sources have had to actually produce retractions on because of how untrue the allegations actually were. So I think that had we had a better media in Alberta actually covering the government properly like it should be, a lot of these stories would be better known to the public.
Yeah, and there's lots of reasons why we want that to happen. And, you know, we here at Western Context believe that through a fair and honest media, the citizenry gets the government that it deserves. And one of those checks and balances on that is the power of grassroots democracy, which has been a bedrock in Alberta going back even prior to the formation of the Reform Party in the late 1980s. But this is actually a huge victory for the old Wild Rose Alliance and Wild Rose Party, because citizen initiative legislation and recall legislation are two pieces of legislation that the Wild Rose Alliance wanted in 2008. Daniel Smith also campaigned on them in the 2012 campaign, and Brian Jean also campaigned on them in the 2015 campaign. And there was a lot of thought coming in with Jason Kenney. Of course, he ran for the leadership of the Progressive Conservatives in founding the UCP, and there was lots of thought, is he going to effectively become a progressive conservative, or are we actually going to see this United Conservative Party work and see some of the policies that the Wild Rose have wanted for a decade plus at this point make their way into the legislation of Alberta? And here we are at the end of this spring session. We have both citizen initiative legislation and recall legislation, the law of the land in Alberta. And this has been something that was that the Wild Rose had wanted for a long time.
Yeah, exactly. And I think that that's something that the media could have talked about quite a bit more had they actually gone on and did more of a deep dive into what the Jason Kenney government was up to in the past year, but instead they've been focused on other things, which is why we're here talking about the stories that they're not talking about.
Yeah, and you know, that's our core mission here, and if you want to help us fulfill that, before we move on to our next story, I'll just take a moment to mention our Patreon page, which you can find at patreon.com/westerncontext if you want to support the podcast monetarily. For $2 a month, or as little as the price of a cup of coffee, you can help us remove bias and sensationalism from the news and media. For $5 a month, the price of a sandwich, you can continue to help us do that and have your name read out on the podcast if you want. And for $10 a month, you can become a Western Context insider and gain an insight into our work and gain pre-release access to our production and show notes throughout the entire week. Now, you might be wondering, what are we going to be doing with this? Well, when we reach $30 a month in contributions, patrons will receive an exclusive monthly news article expanding on topical stories of the month, and this article will continue to provide the context and information you've come to expect from us. At $60 a month, you can expect a news and review podcast every other month where we reflect on the news the month in a candid way and provide opinion on where affairs might be headed next. We also do have an option to make a one-time contribution as well via PayPal, which you can learn more about at westerncontext.ca/support.
As we've seen over the past few years, there has been a greater disconnect between media companies, journalists, and ordinary Canadians. Now, nowhere have we seen this more than with the publicly funded CBC, which, as a federal crown corporation, gets millions of dollars every year of taxpayers' money just to operate. Now, it's been a bone of contention for years, and a recent decision by the editor-in-chief of CBC and executive director of Daily News, Brody Fenlon, to turn off all Facebook comments on CBC news stories has people up in arms. Now, Fenlon describes the pandemic as having a toll on the mental health of Canadians, which has been very true, given on how so many different crises have come up. But he also used words describing Canadians' mental health right now as fragile, and saying that journalists have had it really tough covering a health crisis that they're living through as well. Now, along with social media attacks causing havoc on their mental health, Fenlon says that audience members will inevitably be confronted by hate, racism, and abuse if they talk about CBC news stories on social media. Now, Fenlon says, quote, "If public discourse is a litmus test for the health of a society, the conversation on social media suggests that we have a problem. It's one thing for our journalists to deal with toxicity on these platforms. It's another for our audience members who try to engage with and discuss our journalism to encounter it on platforms such as Facebook and Twitter, where they are almost guaranteed to be confronted by hate, racism, and abuse. And Fenlon says, quote, "That's why beginning on Wednesday and for the next month, we will close comments on all news links and video posts to the Facebook pages belonging to the journalism division of the CBC. So what does this mean for us? Why exactly should we be caring about what the CBC does? Well, Jesse Brown, who is the editor-in-chief of Canada Land and outside of the mainstream media, took to Twitter to say that the CBC is saying that, quote, "the public should pay us to tell stories but should not be allowed to publicly comment on them," is not exactly a position that is consistent with the basic notion of public broadcasting. In a sense, it's taxpayers paying for one-way discourse that can't be commented on. Now, since the article came out, the media establishment has been quick to leap to the defense of the CBC. Now, soon after the article came out, hashtag #DefundCBC was trending in Canada on Twitter, and as Jesse Brown says, quote, "No surprise, the wound is self-inflicted. Did CBC News Editor-in-Chief Brody Fenlon think he'd be celebrated when he proudly announced that he's shutting down much of the public conversation about public news content?" And as with any public influencer wants to do, you end up cultivating your community by moderating out the worst comments while still allowing for discussion to flourish. As we enter the social media age, it has become apparent that unmoderated comments were an invitation for the very worst to shoot off their mouths, and anybody who has grown up with the internet could tell you that. But it is the responsibility of companies to moderate their audiences. But CBC doesn't really think of itself as more of a public influencer and as needing to grow and cultivate their community, because as they're the public broadcaster, they get their money directly from taxpayers anyways, so they don't need to build their views, they don't need to grow their community. They'd rather just silence out their audience completely and not have to worry about it. Now, as a special footnote to this story, Fenlon says at the very end of his article that the CBC will, quote, "continue to welcome comments on our website, cbcnews.ca, where we have more moderating tools and can focus our attention better on offering a respectful dialogue about our stories." Well, except there's now a big sign above the comment section on that very same article that now says, quote, "commenting is now closed for this story." So at the end of the day, Western liberal democracies are predicated on free speech. Now, despite Justin Trudeau's opposition to free speech personally, the tension of well-argued oppositional ideas still drives us toward what is better. It's also a very big tenet of science, where you come up with a hypothesis and then everybody is free to look at what you're saying and then is able to either try to prove or disprove your hypothesis at will. This is not only a big thing in Western democracy, but it is also a very core tenet of what makes science good and why it is able to constantly improve our society by having core tenets and our core beliefs challenged and proven or either disproven. So what's good for science should be what is good for the media, but as we can see, our governments and the media have not really wanted to go along with this. And Trudeau also showed his contempt for the Canadian media this week when he was talking at the end of the G7 meeting in England, and he said that, quote, "the impacts of this G7 will be felt long after the newspapers you write for will have been used to wrap fish." Now, like Trudeau, the CBC does not want opposition. They just want us to pay them to tell us things, whether true or not. Now, the government now has a media that thinks along the exact same lines, and Canadians are worse off for it.
And if the pandemic has shown us one thing, it's that accurate reporting and everything that the media talks about is what generally informs the citizenry. I know a number of weeks back we had the discussion about what effect masks had versus what effect social distancing had versus what effect ventilation might have had inside of an environment when it comes to spreading the COVID-19 virus. And there was a lot of discussion that had been going on about ventilation going back even into 2020, but only now we're starting to see the media talk about some of this as we move away from the pandemic. The same thing, of course, could be said about the Wuhan lab leak theory, but at the end of the day, those were forbidden subjects by the media. Anybody who dared talk about them on their own platform was effectively deplatformed in the case of YouTube. And, you know, when it comes down to it, at the end of the day, CBC is making pretty much the same decision here because they are saying that we're going to make the news. And this is the news as we see it. And, you know, you guys are free to comment and talk about this in your own circles, but if it's on our own Facebook page, that's not allowed. And, you know, it also shows a little bit of hypocrisy, too, in that comments were turned off for that story on their own website, which I think, if anything, in this day and age, we need more discourse when it comes to the news cycle. And this is something that all the other news companies as well have started to look at it as well. You know, you can look at what Global might be doing, what CTV might want to do after this, and pretty much any other news agency in Canada. They'll see CBC do this, and they'll see this as a potential blueprint for a way to run their website. And as we've talked about, you need this open discourse. And if you don't have that open discourse, that really benefits no one. And at the end of the day, Canadians will suffer because of that.
Yeah, exactly. And the fact that so many other journalists are looking at what the CBC is doing here and thinking that it's a good thing and that their own company should do this themselves, well, I mean, it's just giving more power to the media with no oversight. And in the sense that it's just the cherry on top that they say, well, they're just closing it on Facebook and they're just making it so that the worst comments can't be posted. Well, if you'd actually ever looked at a CBC comments section, it's not like they do any good job moderating there, despite what they're talking about. They're allowing this to happen, and they're creating their own problem that they are then fixing by having a heavy-handed approach. And in the sense that even that very same article that had that even said that they were going to keep the comments open, well, not 2 days later, the comment section has been closed. And it just means that there's no discourse that can happen after a certain amount of time. Whereas on social media, you can bring up a story if you want to, and you can talk about it. And that should be something that's free for Canadians to do, especially when it comes to a public broadcaster that through their taxes they are paying for. And I think that's the biggest thing about this story, is that it's not just a private company doing whatever it wants to do to try and appeal to its shareholders or its customers. This is a public broadcaster that is getting money from the government to operate. So by doing this, the government is saying that it's pretty much complicit in what the CBC is doing here, and that they're wanting to have the death of traditional media commenting discourse as well, because that's not what they want either. The government doesn't want opposition, and well, this is just we're seeing this more and more with the government wanting to have less and less opposition to what they're doing, because they don't want to improve, they don't want to become better, they just want to do things the way they want them to do. And, well, we've seen this week with CBC, and, well, we've been seeing it with Trudeau for quite some time, a bit longer.
Yeah, and this story has, of course, also drawn the attention of international journalist Glenn Greenwald, who is most known for breaking the Edward Snowden news in 2013, commented on this and said that, you know, with this is the media still making the news. They're going to limit what their readers can discuss, but at the end of the day, the CBC and the media in general is still going to be free to ruin people's lives and publish stories that may or may not be true because they're in that echo chamber and they are not open to that feedback, and this irrevocably harms the dialogue going forward. So that was an interesting take, and it got the eye of an international journalist, which, you know, when Canada does that, that's something that we pay attention to here at Western Context. But of course, you know, everybody has been talking about the pandemic and that international eye had turned to Canada at one point in terms of how our vaccine program was going. Because, you know, many times we have had to talk about our vaccine program here on the show, and it leaves a lot to be desired. We're still far behind the Americans and other countries such as Israel when it comes to second dose administration, and our vaccine program has been shifting and moving to accommodate a political system that has sought to use it to buy goodwill with Canadians. This week, the government announced that those who received AstraZeneca as a first vaccine should preferably receive an mRNA vaccine from Pfizer or Moderna for dose number two. This comes, of course, after officials in government, including the Prime Minister, suggested that the best vaccine that somebody should take is the first one offered to you. Now people are being told that maybe you should consider Pfizer or Moderna for dose number two, and the messaging out of the government on this makes it look as though that the government is only attempting to buy goodwill with this story. And the framing of this goes as follows into the potential fall election that many are predicting. We've had a slow rollout, but presently Canada is number two in the world for first doses administered. This can then be copied for the second doses, leading to an all-round feeling of success. The Canadian political class and media use America and other countries to show how Canada is better than them. But when it comes to showing where we lag behind, that reporting does not happen. As a result, the massive administration of first doses followed by a quick second dose program will be used to paint a picture of success ahead of a potential fall election. The government has been angling for this since announcing the first dose strategy, and the media has in large part played along, helping build this narrative of success. But in reality, there's actually very little to cheer about in our vaccine rollout. This week, we got news that Canada paid a premium to get early access to 250,000 Pfizer doses in December 2020. We know that we paid more than other countries, but the details of what we paid were redacted from the documents that were published. With this, we also learned about the timings of our vaccine program in relation to purchasing. Pfizer and the government of Canada reached a deal in July of 2020 for the first 20 million doses, with a contract being signed in late October. Recall that Canada's first vaccine deal that we made was in partnership with China for the Sinovac vaccine. This deal ultimately fell apart because of the reluctance of the Chinese government to send vaccine materials to Canada, and that the vaccine was only around 50% effective. This deal was put together in May, but we only found out in August that the deal collapsed days after the agreement was announced. And it was only after the collapse of this deal that we learned that our government had actually made deals with Pfizer and Moderna, the two American mRNA vaccine manufacturers. These sorts of deals are often made in confidence because when a government and corporation do business, it does the corporation no good if their benchmark price is on display for other countries, and these confidentiality clauses are often part of the deal. Using what information we have from the budget, we can estimate that Canada paid about $9 billion for the 250 million doses that were pre-ordered, or about $36 per shot. In comparison, we paid $163 million for the 20 million AstraZeneca doses ordered, or about $8.15 per shot. NDP health critic Don Davies said that he's frustrated with the health committee's request for the unredacted documents. We've, of course, been saying for months here that the government has been behind the ball on vaccinations and has been using every tool at their disposal, from ignoring dose guidelines for second doses to using the media to frame our vaccine program as a success. The early glimpse into the Pfizer contract shows that it was not a success and that the media had been covering up key facts or not reporting accurately since the pandemic began. It also confirms that the government of Canada trusted China to implement a vaccine more than what many see as our number one ally, the United States. Of course, many in the U.S. also didn't believe that there'd be a vaccine in time for Christmas because they didn't like President Trump. But here we are, we had it and paid through the nose for it.
Yes, there's been a lot of misinformation around Canada's vaccine campaign, a lot of it coming from the government itself, which is, of course, obviously trying to frame it as a complete success. But in doing so, it's been covering up all of the not successes that have been going on, and one of which was the complete ignoring of health recommendations to delay second doses. Now, of course, that has come round, and there has been new science on that. And well, it's turned out that that's not such a bad thing after all. But in the sense that there has been a lot of things where the Canadian government has been making decisions, and then only later has the science been actually proving them right on that matter. It doesn't make it any better, because it just means that if they made decisions and the science didn't prove them right, well, that's just Canadians' health that they're toying with. And it should have gotten them a lot more coverage that they were doing that, but because of the rush for vaccines that Canadians were going for, it really didn't get talked about in the media whatsoever. And that's something that we covered here, but the mainstream wasn't really mentioning it very much. And in the sense that all of the finances surrounding just how much they paid for how much of the vaccines that they were able to get, it's been widely known now that the Canadian government has been paying more per vaccine than almost any other government in the entire world. And we should be much further along with our second dose vaccines than we are. But, well, because we don't have that domestic capacity to create vaccines in Canada, well, we're ending up having to pay more for less. And where have we seen this before? Well, it's pretty much every other economic theory that the Trudeau government has crafted over the last 6 years, in the sense that we've been paying more for less for quite some time. And we see this more and more in the last couple of months with the inflation tax crisis settling in to Canadians, and in the sense that in May we've been paying quite a bit more for just basic goods and services year over year than we had in any other month in the past. And this is something that should have received a lot more attention, but well, once again, the Canadian government is wanting to cover up what they didn't do right and talk about the very, very few things that they did.
And this whole vaccine story has become one that has been largely focused on setting the narrative. And you would look at any ordinary vaccine rollout and you would think that public health would be first. And anybody who is in government or works for the government can make that argument that, throughout the entirety of the pandemic, public health has been first. But at the same point, every step along the way has been politicized. And there's a lot of people in the center who we have known to feel politically homeless. And as a result of that, don't like to see things such as basic as public health during a pandemic politicized. And, as a result, the government has done that at every turn. And it's led to a good number of questions about our vaccine procurement, but it's actually already led to a good deal of discussion around national security as well, and in particular, the virology lab in Winnipeg, which is raising many more questions today than it should be.
Yes, and that is what we are going to be discussing in our firing line segment, which is the topic where we talk about all of the stories that really don't get as much coverage in the media. And this story just happens to be one of those. Because I think if the Conservative Party in opposition wasn't raising the alarm over this issue, then I think that the media wouldn't be talking about this story whatsoever. And it's a doozy. Erin O'Toole, the opposition leader of the Conservatives, well, he pulled Conservative MPs from a special National Security Committee on Thursday, and he accused the government of using it to cover up an incident that caused two scientists at Canada's high security laboratory to be fired. Now, the Conservative leader told the House of Commons that his party's members are withdrawing effectively immediately from the National Security and Intelligence Committee of Parliamentarians. O'Toole charged that the committee is, quote, now being used as a political tool by the Prime Minister to cover up the Winnipeg lab incident. He said that Conservatives will never be complicit in Liberal corruption. and Health Minister Patty Hajdu accused the Conservatives of playing political games with national security. But shortly thereafter, all opposition parties joined forces to pass a Conservative motion declaring that the Public Health Agency of Canada is in contempt of Parliament, having refused to obey a House order to produce unredacted documents related to the firing of scientists Xian Guo Qiu and her husband Kading Qing in January. Now, the pair had been escorted out of the Winnipeg's National Microbiology Laboratory in July of 2019 over what the Public Health Authority of Canada had described as being, quote, relating to possible breaches in security protocols. Now, the motion also summons the PHAC President Ian Stewart to appear before the bar of the House of Commons on Monday to be admonished by the Speaker and to produce the documents. Now, calling someone to the bar of the House is a rarely used procedure to essentially publicly shame a person who has committed, quote, an offense against the dignity or authority of Parliament, according to the House of Commons Procedure and Practice, 3rd edition. Now, since 1913, it has not been used against a private citizen, although it has been used twice in 1991 and 2002 to discipline MPs who had grabbed the ceremonial mace during heated Commons proceedings. Now, Stewart and Hajdu have both said that the scientists firing had nothing to do with the fact that Q oversaw a shipment of Ebola and Hennepin viruses to China's Wuhan Institute of Virology in March of 2019. Now, they've also said that there's no connection to COVID-19, a coronavirus that first appeared in China's Hubei province, where Wuhan is, and which some believe may have been released by the Virology Institute, which is a theory that is becoming more and more likely as the days go on and as investigations into the matter are continuing. Now, nevertheless, opposition parties continue to suspect a link and are demanding to see unredacted documents about both the transfer of viruses to the Wuhan Institute and the subsequent firings. Now, Stewart has twice refused to comply with the Canada-China Relations Committee order to produce those documents, saying that federal justice officials have advised him that it would be a breach of privacy laws, could interfere in an ongoing police investigation, and jeopardize national security. Now, opposition parties had joined forces earlier this month to pass a motion in the Commons ordering that the PHAC to turn over all unredacted documents to the parliamentary law clerk, who would confidentially review them and redact anything that he felt would compromise national security or the ongoing police investigation. Now, it specified that the Canada-China Relations Committee, after consulting with a law clerk, could choose to make public any redacted material. Instead, the minority Liberal government provided the unredacted documents to the all-party National Security Committee, whose members must have top security clearance and are bound to secrecy. Now, that committee, which was created in 2017 to review sensitive matters, submits classified reports to the Prime Minister, which are then later tabled in Parliament in edited form. Now, Speaker Anthony Rota ruled on Wednesday that it is not a committee of Parliament, and therefore it's not an acceptable alternative to having a Commons committee examine the documents. He further ruled that the Commons and its committees have unfettered power to order the production of documents, no matter how sensitive, and to determine how they're to be handled. Consequently, he found that there is a prima facie case that the government has breached parliamentary privileges. But the public health minister, Patty Hajdu, had continued to argue on Thursday that the National Security Committee is the, quote, appropriate body to examine the documents. She said in the House of Commons, quote, once again, we see the Conservatives playing games with national security, and on this side of the House, we will never do that, which, of course, O'Toole countered that the National Security Committee is not allowed by law to review active investigations. And this is something that was very clear in what is actual parliamentary guidelines. And in the sense that Parliament is always going to be have supremacy over the executive branch and what is going to be released under means of national security. Now, opposition parties voted on Thursday to declare the Liberal government in contempt of Parliament for refusing to provide the documents to the House of Commons, and the vote passed 176 to 150. Now, there are more than 250 pages of records on the matter that have been withheld from MPs. Now, Rob Walsh, who served as the House of Commons law clerk between 1999 and 2012, said that Thursday's vote was significant because it asserted the supreme role of Parliament, and Walsh said that the attempt by MPs to formally demand the confidential information is significant because it is the first time that the House has ever passed a motion that censures a public servant, Mr. Stewart, for refusing to cooperate with MPs. Now, Walsh said that the Commons has stood firm on its long-standing rights to supremacy over the executive, as it did in 2010 when former Commons Speaker Peter Milliken ordered the Harper government to release secret documents pertaining to the Canadian Forces' treatment of captured Taliban prisoners in Afghanistan. Now, the last time that someone was charged with being in contempt of Parliament was for former Conservative MP and Cabinet Minister Bev Odeh in 2011 over spending discretions. Parliament was dissolved because of a greater vote of non-confidence in the Harper government at the time. Now, Canadians clearly didn't agree with the early election that was being forced by the opposition as they re-elected Stephen Harper with a majority a few weeks later. Now, this is a huge story that has gone largely uncovered by the Canadian media. The Trudeau government would get away with their secrecy if they were still in a majority government. Now, only the United Oppositions are actually holding them to account. In the last 6 years, Trudeau has tried to sweep much more under the rug. Now, imagine what we don't know about.
Yeah, and that's the huge question. What don't we know about? Because, you know, we've been on the record here at Western Context that there's lots of questions when this government that comes to this government in China, and in particular how the government conducts itself when dealing with the Chinese regime. And there's lots of questions that need to be answered on that. And in particular, what we see here as a case of national security that, it, you know, you look at this on the surface, it's one individual being held in contempt of Parliament, but then it's actually the Public Health Agency of Canada being held in contempt of Parliament, which turns out to directly link to the Health Committee. And, you know, that has its fingerprints entirely on the hands of the Liberal government. And there needs to be a huge discussion here on what exactly contempt of Parliament means in this case.
Oh, exactly, totally. And it's amazing that the media is not really covering this story with the amount of detail that it deserves, because this is a major story for a government public health agency to be held in contempt of Parliament for not withholding documents. It makes you wonder what exactly is in those documents and why exactly there is such a connection that could be made between these two scientists that were fired allegedly on security breaches, and how much cooperation they were doing with the Wuhan Institute of Virology, which has been in the news, of course, for the COVID lab leak theory that has been gaining steam and has been picking up in media around the world as well, as to the fishy nature of what's going on and the answers that should be given out and that the Chinese government is trying to hide. So we have to wonder what exactly the Canadian government is trying to hide on this matter and why exactly there seems to be such a huge amount of cooperation between the highest security virology lab that we have in Canada and the one in Wuhan, China. And, well, there's a lot of questions to be answered with this story, and we hope that we will get those answers very soon once the head of the Public Health Agency of Canada, Ian Stewart, is forced to come towards the House of Commons to receive his reprimand for defying the will of Parliament.
And just to pivot back to the whole discussion on this, prior to the case here in 2011 that saw the former Harper government held in contempt of Parliament, I don't think there was a case in the entirety of the British Commonwealth where a government had been held in contempt of Parliament. Granted, this is not the government of Canada today being held in contempt of Parliament, but it's one of its agencies, the Public Health Committee, that is being held in contempt of Parliament. And that's still a pretty big deal. And, you know, many Canadians would see this issue as in the weeds, but nonetheless, it's something that's very important to be talking about. And that takes us nicely into our Word of the Week.
Yeah, so our Word of the Week this week is contempt, which is the feeling that a person or a thing is beneath consideration, worthless, or deserving scorn. Now, in a law sense, this means that a person has either defied the will of a law court or of an elected body. And, well, we've seen contempt a lot this week. We've seen contempt by Justin Trudeau towards the media, saying that what he does at the G7 is much more important than what they write in newspapers that will be used to wrap fish. There's also been contempt by the media towards ordinary Canadians, with the CBC turning off their Facebook comments and trying to stifle discussion on their own site. And of course, there's been contempt with the Alberta media towards the Alberta government, which has done a lot of the things that it said it was going to do. And, well, we've seen contempt with the Canadian government towards the Canadian public based on the vaccines and just what they aren't telling us about the link between the two scientists in Winnipeg and what happened in the Wuhan Institute of Virology. And, well, there's a lot of contempt to go around this week, but we will always be here to cover whatever is going on, and we will always give you the news that the media doesn't seem to want you to get.
That's entirely right. And, you know, it's this relationship that exists between, or rather that the media thinks exists between them and their readers. And, you know, there's very few media agencies out there and journalists who see that. Many people see themselves and journalists as a very high, holy position. And, you know, journalists do need to do the work that breaks these stories at the end of the day. And yes, there are good journalists out there, but there's a good number of journalists and media agencies that do hold a contempt for the population. And that's precisely why we're here. And if you want to find full show notes, you can find the full show notes and read them and find our supplementals and all of the stories that we've talked about at westerncontext.ca. You can also subscribe to our podcast on any number of podcast listeners out there, all at westerncontext.ca/subscribe. We've got Apple Podcasts, Google, Pocket Casts, and many more. And of course, we're also on Twitter and Facebook, where you can share our stories freely and comment on them freely. Both of that at Western Context. And of course, we also see the shows there. So with that being said, we'll be back next week for another episode of Western Context.
And we'll always look through all the news of the media that they don't talk about and a lot that they will talk about, but in a different way. We're going to cover all sides of the story, no matter where you find them, in radio, TV, print, or online. We will find them, and we will give you the coverage needed to put yourselves on the right side of the news. So with that said, we'll be back next week for another episode of Western Context.